This week I'm talking about poetry, politics and sexuality, surrealism in Latin America. The surrealists have often been described as the latest in a long line of European invaders since Columbus, who have invented an America in the service of their own desires and interests. There has also been a fairly wide move to reclaim artists who have been absorbed into the general histories of 20th century art, such as Lang or Mattel, Frida Kahlo, from those histories and replace them in their own context in Latin America, in a way trying to sideline their surrealist connections. And what I've decided to do today is to take two people who are both from within Latin America and who represent very different kinds of involvement with surrealism. One is a poet, would have liked to be a painter but really wasn't, and the other is a painter. The first is César Moro and the other is Frida Kahlo. Their paths do cross at one point, and I'm partly going to be telling the story of how they finally came to meet. César Moro was the only Hispanic poet to contribute to the Paris Surrealist magazines and to the movement's manifestos and pamphlets in the 1920s and early 30s. César Moro is a pseudonym. He was born Alfredo Quispes Acín in Lima in 1904 and died there in 1956. In 1925, he went to Paris, where he hoped to be a painter, and he took part in two group shows in 1926 and 1927, but sold nothing at all. In 1928, he discovered surrealism and joined Breton and the group, coming quite close, contributing to pamphlets like Violette Nozière, and he eventually became an important, if solitary, figure in the internationalization of the movement. Now, The Scandalous Life of César Moro, which is the title of this small collection of his poems in English, is not an autobiographical confession, but it's the title of a poem. The scandal is the fate of the poet. In a flood of vivid surrealist images figuring dispersal, darkness, and illicit love, and I quote, "Disperse me in the rain or in the stream of cloudbursts passing, at the edge of the night in which we see ourselves through running clouds, which appear to the eyes of lovers who leave their mighty castles blood-turreted, ice-turreted, staining the ice, ripping the leap of late returns." Renommée d'amour. I was just going to flash up a slide of Frida Kahlo, to whom I will return as the contrast to tomorrow that I'm going to be talking about. Renommée de l'amour, which is the poem you can see on the left here, as it was published in the surrealist journal Surrealisme au service de la Révolution in 1933, was written in French, as was most of his poetry. And even the letters to his closest friend and collaborator, the Peruvian poet Emilio Westphalen, are in French, not Spanish. Distancing himself from his family, his language, and his country, Moro was a multiple outsider. And his sexuality also marginalized him, though it was only with Breton's book of 1944, Arcane 17, that this led to a break with the movement. I think that I would just like to say that attitudes to non-normative sexualities within surrealism are actually more open than the often repeated accusations of homophobia against Breton would indicate. It's no coincidence that surrealists Cyrillist adherents around the world were often outsiders in their own communities, socially, sexually, and politically. For Moro, especially after the Second Manifesto of 1929, which clearly spelt out the rejection of père, patron, patrie, father, boss, and country, Cyrillism was a liberating international collective. Renommée d'amour, and I've put up the manuscript for another poem called Les Perversions Sexuelles, Sexual Perversions, which is about nothing of the kind, of Moro, 1932. Renommée d'amour, Jason Wilson, in his essay on Moro, called it a passionate, courtly love in 20th century guise. The poem is, like Breton's famous Union Libre, or Free Union, 1931, an incantation to desire, and you can see the repetitions of two, 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 as he addresses love, actually. But unlike, it's an incantation to desire, like Breton's Union Libre, but unlike that, which celebrates the woman's body in detail, bit by bit, Moro's poem pursues a much darker vision of love, passionate but desperate, dedicated, and I quote, to that unique love without regret, without happiness, without turning back, to the harrowing mournings of those whom love rejects, to mournings sadder than all else, the better to efface my name, to shake off the dust and return to dust. Well, Moro did promote surrealism across the Latin American continent, but he was not a self-promoter. Other things, poetry, love, and rebellion, were more important than individual fame and success. He actually struggled to make a living throughout his life, and the Peruvian novelist Mario Vargas Llosa remembered, dimly he said he remembered, being taught French by Moro in Lima in the 1950s at his military academy. In the face of the hostility of the students, Moro remained impassive, polite, distant, apparently impervious to the taunts. A rumour that he was a homosexual and a poet fueled their insolence. By then, he was no longer promoting surrealism, but still writing poetry, though most only became available after his death in 1956. So, following his trajectory between Europe, Peru, and Mexico, which I shall do through the lecture, threading it through, gives some idea of the complexity of surrealism's reception and dissemination in Latin America, the tension between the pressures of cultural nationalism and surrealism's anti-nationalism, between political commitment and individual freedom. Moro remained, all through, a total nonconformist. In this famous surrealist map of the world from Variété in the early 30s, the map is redrawn, as you can see, according to the value, cultural or political, that can be accorded countries, territories, or cities. You can see that England has basically disappeared from a dot. Ireland is larger. Paris is just the city, and then there's Germany. Very large Russia. Then in the American continent, only Mexico and Peru have survived the reworking. Alaska and Labrador are there as, I think, probably because of both Mexico and Peru and there, those Alaska, because of both pre-conquest civilizations and also possibly because they still had extensive indigenous populations, both reasons for the surrealist special interest. The newly independent American states of the late 18th and early 19th century differed markedly from the mid-19th century nationalisms of Europe, which have dominated provincial European thinking about nationalism, even before the negative cast given nationalism by the rise of fascism and the Second World War. The difference is, for example, that language is not a distinguishing element in the Spanish-speaking continents, and there is a different role for class, I think. I'm not going to go into this in any detail. But there is, I think, one has one of a different kind of cultural nationalism, a different kind of imaginary community, which is a very powerful force in Latin America. Now, the Latin American avant-gardes, mushrooming in the 1920s, took their cue in many ways from the European isms of futurism, Dada, and then surrealism. But the question I would ask was how compatible this eclectic cosmopolitanism was with the powerful cultural nationalism of the American nations. The attitudes of Dada and surrealism in particular were set against national interests and ideas. And I quote from Hans Richter, who was a Dadaist and wrote a very good study of the movement, Dada Art or Anti-Art. I quote Richter, "We wanted to bring forward a new kind of human being, free from the tyranny of rationality, of banality, of generals, fatherlands, nations, art dealers, microbes, resident permits, and the past." And this subversive anarchist attitude, which sets the artist against his or her society, appears in Latin America, and in a sense, I think, is quite close to Morrow. I would quote the Salvadorian writer Salarue, his notorious statement in the Costa Rican journal Repertorio Americano, "Yo no tengo patria," I do not have a country. But elsewhere, the story is very different. And I think this relationship between the cosmopolitanism and nationalism took a new form. For example, with the anthropophagy movement in Brazil, which I will be coming back to later in the series, but I'm just showing you now a painting called Anthropophagy, that is Cannibalism, by Tarsila do Amaral from 1928. And the page of the manifesto of Anthropophagy from the Revista de Antropofagia by Osvaldo de Andrade. And he suggests that anthropophagy, that cannibalism, allows the new world to ingest, absorb, and transform its colonizers and their traditions. This is a kind of solution. And I quote from the manifesto, "Only anthropophagy unites us, socially, economically, philosophically. We want the Caraíba revolution, bigger than the French Revolution. Natural man, Rousseau. From the French Revolution to Romanticism, to the Bolshevik Revolution, to the Surrealist Revolution. We continue on our path. We made Christ be born in Baia. Anthropophagy, the permanent transformation of taboo into totem. We already had communism. We already had surrealist language. The golden age." End quote. So the ability to draw on European as well as on their own traditions could be an advantage rather than a weakness. As the Mexican writer Alfonso Reyes said about the new civilization that he believed would follow in Mexico after the revolution, "We have a practice of international living not possessed by Europeans." Theirs was a real internationalism, those who were able to travel, beside which the Europeans appeared provincial. And at the bottom there, I was just going to note that the travel of people like Tarsila do Amaral, Oswald Dandraje to Europe began to be paralleled in reverse. There became a more two-way traffic with the surrealists, who were among the first not just to look beyond Europe, but actually to go beyond it. Set up a two-way traffic. The bottom there is a lecture that Perret gave in the 1920s on surrealism in São Paulo. Journals such as Sur, Buenos Aires, Amauta, and Los Contemporáneos had a policy of joining European achievement to American promise. They published translations of English and French writers and introduced artists and filmmakers such as Man Ray and Eisenstein to an American audience. The Peruvian Review Amauta, I put up the editorial page here, was founded in 1926, and it was interested in surrealism as part of a broad network of leftist artists and intellectuals. Its editor, Mariátegui, founded the Peruvian Socialist Party, for which he took as model not the USSR, but the Andean Commune, or AILU, based on pre-conquest social and economic structures. Amauta welcomed the contact between La Révolution Surréaliste and Clarté in the mid-30s, hoping for a merger in a new review to be called La Guerre Civile, in 1928. Surrealism was seen not just as a symptom of the decadence of capitalist civilization, evident in the atomization and dissolution of its art, but as an active rejection of bourgeois culture. Mariátegui published a poem of Moreau's in 1928, and Breton was one of the few contributors to be honoured with a full-page portrait, which you see here. But when Moreau returned to Lima, Mariátegui was already dead, and he didn't seem to have had so much contact with the Amauta group. He returned penniless to Lima in 1933, where he met Emilio Westphalen. And I put up here, I don't know if you can read it, but this is from a notebook of poems that he wrote in 1934, which are illustrated with his drawings, very, very strange, slightly biomorphic figures that could be animal, could be vegetable, could be people. And they're quite sexualized, but they are also fairly abstract. And the poems he dedicates on the left-hand side to André Breton and to Paul Éluard with the endless admiration of César Moreau. In 1934, he wrote a text called Los Anteojos de Azufre, Sulphur Goggles, which was not published until 1958, after his death. Here, Moreau attacks the stultified provincial art and poetry of Peru. Really vicious attack. He was very, very good at polemics. And he says, the only poetry that was worthy of the name was by the inmates of the mental asylum, the Hospital Larco Herrera, where he worked as a librarian, and also organized a museum of the inmates' paintings. He encouraged them to paint. And these are two examples from his collection of paintings by patients in the hospital. One of them is actually dedicated to Moreau. And I think it would be very interesting to do more work on these paintings and how he was actually influential in what is reproduced. The one on the left, very curiously, resembles a 16th century, early 17th century manuscript by Guamán Pomo de Ayala, and I don't know whether the person who did it knew about this, but they are quite interesting. Moreau put on the first Surrealist exhibition in Lima in 1935. The majority of the paintings, drawings and collages were actually by Moreau himself. There was a strongly Dada flavour. This is a collage by Moreau on the right here. A strongly Dada flavour to the catalogue. There are texts by Francis Picabia, former Dadaist, and Moreau included an extremely insulting commentary on the Chilean writer Vicente Huidobro, who was a major figure in the avant-garde. Moreau calls Huidobro an arabist. He accuses him of plagiarising Buñuel's poem and Giraffe, and sums him up as a mediocre copyist, nauseating, literary, rotten puppet, sowing confusion. Huidobro hit back in his little magazine Vital, June 1935, calling Moreau piojo homosexual, a homosexual louse, and a sad servant of surrealism. And it continued, this battle between them. Moreau then published a magazine called The Embottled Bishop, which was dedicated to Huidobro, and Huidobro fought back against that. In fact, Moreau really, in a sense, carried on quite a lot of little kind of wars with other avant-garde groups in Latin America, and even against the Surrealist group in Chile as well. There were inscriptions to the Surrealist poet René Crevel in Moreau's copy of the catalogue of the 1935 Lima exhibition, whose suicide that June 1935 probably related as much to his homosexuality as to the split between the Surrealists and the Communist Party. And these are very poignant. Moreau and Westphalen joined a cell of intellectuals, including Manuel Moreno Jimeno, and in 1936 founded the Comité de Amigos de los Defensores de la República Española, or CADRE. And they produced five numbers of a bulletin attacking fascism in Peru and in Spain. The situation in Peru was oppressive. The dictator general Oscar Benavides supported Franco's fascist rebellion in Spain and had invited Italian fascist advisers to instruct the Peruvian police force on how to suppress dissent. In 1936, the national elections were annulled. And Moro wrote in one of the second Cadre bulletin, "To help distribute this pamphlet is a cultural duty in the face of the barbarism and oppression that blind our country. Intellectuals, workers, students, join a united front against the murderous fascism of Spain, conquerors of Ethiopia, persecutors of the Jews, an enemy to the death of culture and democracy." As a result of the of Cadre, Westphalen was arrested, and Moro fled to Mexico, where he remained until 1948. So I'm now going to move and look briefly at the context in Mexico and at how surrealism in the person of Breton, as well as of Moro, arrived there and coincided there. Cultural nationalism in Mexico was of a different order from that of other Latin American countries. The Mexican Revolution of 1910-20 had done what independence from Spain in 1820 had failed to do. It revealed a Mexico that was no longer identified just with the Creole landowning classes, but included the indigenous peoples, many of whom still spoke their own languages. The mighty and perhaps impossible task of creating a modern nation was not just political, but social and cultural. Artists, writers, and poets disputed the territory, with Rivera and the muralists more prominently occupying the public eye. Other groups included Los Contemporáneos, the magazine of that name, which lasted from 1928 to 31, and also claimed a Mexicanness inflected by modernism. One of the poets associated with that group, and who became really Moro's closest friend in Mexico, was Xavier Villarrutia, and his other close friend, who was Villarrutia's companion, was Agustín Lasso. And I put up on the screen two pages from the journal Forma, which ran from 1926 to 28, with Lasso's own very particular brand of slightly odd realism here. Lasso was a very close friend of Moro as well, and actually tried to continue to teach him to paint in the 1940s. And I can't go in detail into the other artists associated with this group, but one I would like to just mention is Maria Izquierdo, who is very often overlooked because partly of Frida Kahlo's enormous fame and popularity. But she also has her links with surrealism. She was a friend of Antonin Artaud when he visited surrealism, visited Mexico in 1936. I think her paintings show a kind of a very interesting meld of surrealism, new objectivity, and Mexicanism. The building here, the very typical ruined wall and the open window, is very Mexican, but the other elements, in a sense, belong to... They're about games, about playing, and they belong sort of equally to Europe and to Mexico. She's a very, very interesting painter. She was close to the Contemporáneos group, her work was shown in a number of exhibitions, but not in the big 1940 Surrealist exhibition in Mexico City. Now, in 1938, André Breton visited Mexico, and he was, in a sense, immediately annexed by Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo. Although he did meet the other groups, he met Villarrutia, and he certainly saw Moro again. Rivera tried to, as it were, stamp his own mark on this visit by Breton to Mexico. And this is a poster that Rivera made for a lecture of Breton's in Mexico City, and I think it's extremely interesting because of the way that it refers back to Breton's book, The Communicating Vessels. And he makes of the eyes and the vases the notion of something that is one is flowing into the other. The face that is sort of reduced, one open eye, one closed eye, and a brain. But he is also referencing pre-conquest images, particularly the god Tlaloc, who had rings around his eyes. And I think this the way that Rivera is referring back to pre-Columbian images is extremely interesting and is one of the, I think, one of the important factors that actually helped to charm Breton so completely in his visit to Mexico. Mexico is actually the only country that Breton, the Surrealist leader, ever wrote about as such, and it's the one exception to his anti-nationalism. This is the front page of his essay, Memory of Mexico, Souvenir de Mexique, with a photograph by Alvarez Bravo of an assassinated worker during a strike at Tehuantepec above it. And he said in this essay, which was published in Minotaur on his return to Paris, he said, "At least there's one country in the world where the wind of liberation still blows." I quote again, "I know of nothing more exalting than the photographic documents that restore the light of the era of the revolution." And he's talking about the Casa Solo photographs of the barefoot soldiers. Breton also talks about pyramids and tombs, the inexhaustible interplay of life and death in Mexico. He talks of the Indian markets and the very human army he visited in Monterrey. He was very impressed by the way that the soldiers were picnicking and playing with children. And when he pointed this out to Trotsky, who was his companion there, Trotsky said, "Yes, but if you needed that army, what good would it be?" There are a sequence of pages of photographs illustrating the essay on Mexico. This extraordinary sugar skull on the right, which is also reversible. If you turn it up the other way, it's a grinning face. So it's a face and a skull. On the left are two photographs, which are simply called Madame Vaudeville. And these were found, apparently, by Moreau and Breton in one of their expeditions to the flea markets of Mexico City. And here is the trio that came together on Breton's visit to Mexico. Rivera was then looking. He had offered asylum to Trotsky. It's Trotsky on the right, Rivera in the middle, and Breton on the left. And on the left, there are two photographs from Breton's collection of snapshots of this trip to Mexico. The top one showing a picnic with Frida Kahlo and Trotsky. And below it, Breton and Trotsky apparently fishing for axolotls in a river. While they were there, while they were together in Mexico, Breton and Trotsky drew up a manifesto for a new movement. This is 1938. War is obviously on the horizon in Europe. The Communist Party in the Soviet Union has, in their view, betrayed the movement. And Trotsky and Breton wrote a manifesto for the new independent federation for an independent revolutionary art. It was very widely published in pamphlets and in journals. It was actually, I think, originally drawn up by Breton and then substantially revised by Trotsky, but it was published over the signatures of Breton and Rivera. And I quote, "It goes without saying that we do not identify ourselves with the currently fashionable catchword, neither fascism nor communism, a shibboleth which suits the temperament of the Philistine, conservative and frightened, clinging to the tattered remnants of the democratic past. True art, which is not content to play variations on ready-made models, but rather insists on expressing the inner needs of man and of mankind in his time. True art is unable not to be revolutionary, not to aspire to a complete and radical reconstruction of society. We recognise that only the social revolution can sweep clean the path for a new culture. If, however, we reject all solidarity with the bureaucracy now in control of the Soviet Union, it is precisely because, in our eyes, it represents not communism, but its most dangerous and treacherous enemy. So they were searching for common ground to defend the independence of art. But the movement was very short-lived and didn't actually survive the outbreak of war. There were two issues of a journal, Clay, were published, which Morrow was trying to actually get going also in Mexico after Breton's departure. I'll come back for a moment to the photographs accompanying the essay on Mexico. This is by Manuel Alfonso Bravo, Manuel Alvarez Bravo, and it is one of the examples Breton gives of the many registers in which sort of death exists in Mexico, death and life and death. In this case, it's a coffin maker for children's coffins. There's a tiny little coffin, as you can see, which is the advertisement on a plinth. And you can see the coffin stacked up inside. And Breton comments that, I don't know whether this is true, this statistic, but that infant mortality had reached something like 70% in Mexico at the time. This is an engraving by Posada of Zapata, who was also celebrated by Breton as this peon, really, to Mexico and Mexican Revolution. Another engraving of Posada. Posada was one of those artists who was claimed by the post-revolutionary muralists and by the other groups of artists as a sort of precursor. This particular woodcut shows as skeletons, as calaveras, riding bicycles, the different newspapers representing different political and social sectors of society. And you can see there's a revolutionary hat, there's a bowler hat, there's a top hat for the capitalist, there's a feather hat for the dandy, and so on. The Posada engravings are absolutely extraordinary and are highly prized by the muralists. This is the cover of Clay with Pas de Patrie on the front. This is the monthly bulletin of Fiari. Now, I want to go on to look at Frida Kahlo, but before I do so, I just very briefly, as a sort of context and background, both to Kahlo and to Morrow, and to the and to Breton's extraordinarily fruitful visit to Mexico, to look at just a couple of Rivera's murals, because these really were they did establish, I think, the power of the artists in post-revolutionary Mexico to give a face to a country that, in a sense, discovered itself with the revolution. I'm sorry that they're not very good images on the left. These are the bottom two, are two of the panels from the Secretariat of Education in Mexico City by Rivera. They are very, very vivid images in black and gold with the figures standing out against them. But what Rivera has done is to borrow figures from Giotto's frescoes at the Arena Chapel in Padua. You can see Joachim's dream down here. He similarly embeds his peasants within the landscape. And here is a couple embracing outside the gates, and that is like the embrace here. Rivera had visited, Giotto had visited Italy, and he, as it were, brought some of the lessons that he learnt to these major, extraordinary schemes that he completed in the 1920s in Mexico City. This is a chapel. It was originally a chapel, and he turns it into, as it were, a chapel to materialism and the revolution, with this a great figure of the fertile earth instead of Christ at the end above the altar. And this is another of the panels from the Secretariat of Education showing the entrance to the mine. And Rivera very skillfully draws on religious imagery, though in a completely secular context. So this looks a little bit like the Stations of the Cross, people carrying a cross on their shoulders, although the context is very much that of the proletarian in Mexico. And these paintings, even if they were much later criticized for, as it were, implying that the revolution had successfully transformed people's lives in Mexico, it remained a kind of kind of promise for Mexico as a revolutionary nation. That's how it was, I think, one could see it through the 20s and 30s. It also celebrates popular life and popular art. This is another of the panels, and these are more or less life-size. So if you stand in front of it, you look as if you're part of the crowd admiring these calaveras who are dancing up and down on the screen behind. Really, one of the points I want to make is that the Mexican-ness, if you like, of the muralists, of Diego Rivera, was only one aspect of the cultural nationalism that powered so much of the art and the writing in the 20s. And the other, as it were, there was Rivera and the muralist side, and then the more kind of those who wanted to meld that with a more modernist approach. Now, Frida Kahlo, in a sense, is a unique figure here, but I want to talk about her in relation to surrealism. This is a painting, is self-portrait on the borderline, and as you can see, she is standing on, as it were, between, she's standing on a little pedestal which is attached to a motor. The idea that she's like a kind of doll which could be, turn the motor on, she could turn round. She's between the industrial nation United States on the right with the flag among the clouds, and Mexico as a land of myth and ruin, but also of nature. You have the fruit and flowers down here, and the kind of machinery on the right hand side. She holds a Mexican flag, and with the other hand is smoking a cigarette. So that it's a kind of it's a rather ambiguous image. Now, Ida Rodriguez Prampolini, who's a Mexican art historian, in her essay on surrealism and Mexican fantasy for the exhibition catalogue on Los Surrealistas en México in 1986, wrote, "There is no doubt that Breton was hypnotized by our country, but he did not understand that what he was postulating as surreality among us functions in a different way, as real reality, fertilized by a peculiar fantasy, but not like unreal reality, which is what he was after." Here, the deliberate misconception that surrealism intended completely to override reality is drawn into a specious argument primarily intended to distance Frida Kahlo from surrealism. I quote again, "In Mexico, Breton extended surrealism to pre-Hispanic production, to the popular, and dubbed surrealist probably the most realist of our painters, Frida Kahlo." This is now repeated in most accounts of Kahlo, underpinned by her own late statement, "They thought I was a surrealist, but I wasn't. I never painted dreams. I painted my own reality." Now, I raise this not from a desire to pigeonhole Kahlo again, but to restore to surrealism some of the meaning it had, which is not incompatible with this much-quoted statement. Carmen's earliest paintings actually show her in this slightly sort of Art Nouveau manner, very elegant and rather beautifully painted. And she subsequently adopted a much more sort of rudimentary style. This is, again, a self-portrait of Carlo being nursed by Mexico. This is Mother Mexico, whose breast is feeding Carlo. Curiously, not unlike one of those Magritte paintings in which a grown-up's body is attached to a child's, a grown-up's head is attached to a child's body. And the mother is wearing a stone mask from the pre-conquest civilizations from Teotihuacan. Although Carlo denied that she was a surrealist or was interested in surrealism, that was a very late statement. And there's plenty of evidence that she was not only aware of it, but actually played some of the games. On the right is a cadavre exquis, that is a game that the surrealists very much enjoyed playing, when a group of people hand a piece of paper round to one another. The first person draws a head, let's say, and then turns the paper over. Next person draws the body, turns the paper over, and the next person draws the legs, head, body, and legs, known as the exquisite corpse. And this is an exquisite corpse of by Carlo and one of her friends, with the unmistakable head of Diego Rivera on it, on the right-hand side. And on the left is a drawing which clearly indicates that she is drawing a dream. But the model that she adopts, really, most strikingly in her paintings, is that of the popular ex voto, or retablo, as Rivera called it. And this is what Rivera wrote about Carlo in a 1943 article. He said, in her retablos, Frida always paints her own life. Now, this is a painting that was commissioned from Carlo to commemorate the suicide of Dorothy Hale, who jumped from the top of one of the New York skyscrapers wearing a ball gown. And understandably, the person who commissioned it thought it was so horrifying that she refused to buy it, and the frame is stained with blood. And underneath, as you can see, there's an inscription which explains who it is. And this model is taken from the kind of retablo that Rivera is talking about. This is one from 1920. These are little anonymous paintings, very traditional, made as offerings to a particular saint or virgin or Christ, who has interceded when the person who is praying is in some great danger, either from sickness or from violence or something else. Pray to the saint. The saint intercedes, and then as a thanks offering, these little paintings were produced by often professional retablo painters, or sometimes by the person, him or herself. As you can see, this one is dedicated to the El Santo Niño Salvador, who is shown in a frame above the scene. The person can be seen on the bottom right-hand side, who almost got caught up in a violent incident towards the very end of the Civil War. Carlo uses this model of the retablo, but also but transforms it. She sort of subverts it. In this painting, tiny little painting called My Birth, she uses the kind of layout of the retablo with the scroll at the bottom for the inscription, but there is no inscription, because in this case there was no miracle. It was painted just after she had a miscarriage and her own mother had died. And the Virgin of the Sorrows, which is the framed image at the head of the bed, was a very precise memory of an object her devout mother cherished. And I think the directness of the image underlines a conundrum that cannot actually be put into words. Another example of the retablo that Carlo is using here, the self-portrait on the right. Here I painted myself in the mirror. I'm 37. It's the month of July in Coyoacán, and I put up an example of this quite sort of primitive painting that she was. That she was copying there. I think it's interesting that these little icons or images, offerings, are although they're quite widespread in Latin America, and you also find them in Europe, and they are a European tradition, I think, though they really flowered in Mexico, they are a significant aspect of Mexican identity. And I quote from Hobsbawm's study of nationalism. Holy icons represent the symbols and rituals or common collective practices which give a palpable reality to an otherwise imaginary community. And it's very interesting how often the figure of the saint or the Christ is named in relation to a territory, and this particular one here is the Virgin, as Our Lady of San Juan de los Lagos. And I think another instance of Carlo using the very simple interior that you often find in the retablo paintings, and now with instead of a saint or Christ, her doctor in a painting on the easel. And she suffered physically a great deal throughout her life. She underwent numerous operations, and you can see here that she's holding in her hand a palate, which is also an interior organ, a kind of womb or heart. And it's as though she's sort of painting with her own blood. This painting is called What the Water Gave Me. And as you can see, it's as it were, it's her lying in the bath, looking at her feet at the far end, one of which is horribly cracked. And in between herself and the feet, there's an entire landscape of little incidents and narratives, including an encounter between two women on a raft on the right-hand side, Carlo paints female bodies and encounters between two females. This is the two Fridas, Las Dos Fridas. So Frida doubled, Frida as a kind of self-split image, with, as you can see, a vein that runs through right round and down to the scissors that she's holding in her hand, trying to stem the blood that's flowing onto her white dress. This painting was exhibited at the International Surrealist Exhibition in Mexico City, and at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, 20 Centuries of Mexican Art, in 1940. And for the catalogue of the New York show, Carlo's friend Covarrubias wrote, "Almost all Frida Kahlo's paintings are autobiographical, expressed in a dream language that is truly surrealist and motivated by the psychological states of the artist's mind." Carlo herself said, "I never knew I was a surrealist until André Breton came to Mexico and told me I was. The only thing I know is that I paint because I need to, and I paint always whatever passes through my head without any other consideration." I think that she was unaware, as she says, of surrealism before is neither here nor there. I mean, I think it's questionable even that she was unaware of it, but it doesn't matter, because surrealism is built on the recognition of like spirits from the past and the present, regardless of their awareness of the movement itself. And Carlo was one of many artists, like Manuel and Lola Alvarez Bravo, whose work was recognized as cognate with surrealism. And I quote from Breton's essay on Carlo: "At this present point in the development of Mexican painting, which since the beginning of the 19th century has remained largely free from foreign influence and profoundly attached to its own resources, I was witnessing here, at the other end of the earth, a spontaneous outpouring of our own questioning spirit. It was not for their unreal reality, but for thoroughly grounded real, resistant to pure fantasy, that Carlo's paintings and Bravo's photographs were so highly valued by the Surrealists. The fact that Carlo subsequently in her diary experimented with automatic writing and drawing suggests that she found more resources in Surrealism than she subsequently admitted openly. In 1940, Moro and Parlin organised the International Exhibition of Surrealism at the Galería de Arte Mexicano in Mexico City. It was, for many years, it was the only commercial gallery in Mexico City. This is a photograph reversed by Álvarez Bravo on the cover. The exhibition opened on the 17th of January 1940, and at the vernissage, Moro wrote, there was a ridiculous, imbecile, mad crowd. Diego and Carlo were in the exhibition with enormous paintings, Carlo with the two Fridas, and Rivera with a decorative female portrait entitled Mahandragora. Moro, who organised the show and had to deal with Carlo and Frida, who both wanted the most prominent places in the show and painted the largest pictures, said that Diego's titles were Connery, typical Latin American genius, he said, an extraordinary ability to deceive people. Rivera was very sweet to him, Moro. He said, but no one believes in his surrealism, Rivera's surrealism. It's his thousandth attempt to revive his reputation, which is totally unnecessary, as he earns masses in the United States and is considered a genius. And Moro went on, it hasn't worked for him in Paris, despite the promotion in Minotaur. People there have a refined instinct and no painting. And the catalogue, with a photograph by Bravo, was denounced by the Mexican mural painter Siqueiros for the aesthetic crime of Bretonism. It was censored by the gallery, and who actually cut out the final paragraph from César Moro's preface. And in the copy preserved in the Getty Research Institute, Moro has added in his handwriting the last paragraph that was censored, and I quote, "At this precise moment, the Christian era ends. A great wind has been unleashed, but whose origin we see the moral poignant support of Sigmund Freud, which has just dispersed forever the props of Golgotha and death-loving ivy devours the crosses where birds would never live." Surrealist clairvoyance situated the end of the Christian era in 1925. In 1939, we need to remember this. So Moro's attempt at an anti-Christian message in the catalogue failed, and that I think is quite interesting because it shows how delicate and how touchy this subject of religion still was in Mexico at the time. That's the And this is Moro himself standing in the exhibition with a painting by Parlin on the wall. For many years, in the latter part of at least 5 years, Moro and Westphalen had planned a review called El Uso de la Palabra, which was finally published in 1939. And it included an essay by Westphalen on poetry and the critics in Peru, which, as Moro said, is absolutely terrific, very brave, will make you many enemies. And it also included a photograph specially commissioned by Moro from Eva Sulzer of a statue in a park in Mexico City, which he said is utterly scandalous. And this is the photograph of the behind of this statue. Moro also had one criticism of an essay by Westphalen's. It was an essay on Freud, talking about desire in all its forms. Westphalen had listed artistic, scientific, and political, but Moro writes to him and says, what about sexual? Surely this is as important. He also wrote to Westphalen in 1940, at the height of his active engagement with Surrealism and this exhibition, that he wished he could publish somewhere prominent Surrealism's watchwords or slogans, such as, down with work, abat le travail, which, he said, I particularly like, and which was the basic reason for my joining Surrealism. Now, I'm just drawing to a close. I just want to finish by talking a little bit about Moreau's disillusionment with Surrealism, which was quite gradual. This is a photograph, by the way, of him on the beach in Lima after he returned there in 1948. It's one of a series of quite strange posed, performed photographs of him. Now, I think he grew away from Surrealism during the early 40s as much because the movement changed as because he changed. One factor was his friendship with Wolfgang Parlin, the painter and founder of the revue DIN in Mexico. Parlin described DIN as the successor to Surrealism, and he also actually published the only very few, the two publications of Moreau's poems that came out in Mexico, one in an edition of 200 and the other in an edition of only 50. And I'm going to be talking more about Moreau in relation to pre-Columbian and ethnographic questions next week in relation to DIN. Privately, Moreau expressed to Westphalen his doubt that DIN could ever replace Surrealism. Really, he said, I have nothing very definite to offer instead. The times are too cataclysmic to see anything clearly. He became more and more critical of Surrealism, and I'm quoting now always from the letters to Westphalen. I have been thinking about the great fuss Surrealism made about psychoanalysis, and I realised that this fuss was purely lyrical. In The Trajectory of Dream, an anthology of writings about dream and the unconscious put together by Breton, the only good things, Moreau says, are those where the dream is treated poetically. Look at the comic investigations into sexuality and tell me if it doesn't resemble old films. I still hugely admire Surrealism for the positive things it has done in the realm of poetry, but there is a dogmatic side that really pisses me off. It's interesting, I think, that Moreau and Roger Caillois, both of whom were early Surrealist adherents in Paris, and both were active in Latin American avant-gardes, took utterly divergent paths in their respective critiques of Surrealism. While for Moreau what still mattered was the practice of poetry, and the pretensions of scientific or pseudo-scientific experiment or investigation seemed increasingly redundant, Caillois objected to the lyrical and poetic treatment of the mind and the world. Breton, Caillois felt, protected rather than sought to unmask the mysterious and the marvellous. Caillois had taken refuge in Buenos Aires from the war and was a regular contributor to Victorio Campo's important journal, Sur. He refused to publish a review of Moreau's book of poems, Le Château de Grisou, and Moreau comments, I would have been surprised had I not long known that Monsieur Caillois is the declared enemy of poetry and a pedant. C'est un très brillant émergeur, non malien. His own notion of poetry now had changed, and he no longer insisted on automatism. Is poetry automatic? What a joke. One works and chooses the elements provided by automatism, and not, absolutely not, outside all moral or aesthetic preoccupations. That is the misunderstanding Surrealism perpetuates. His disappointment with Breton's latest book, Arcane 17, 1944, was intense, as he spelt out in a long and highly critical review in the Mexican journal El Hijo Prodigo in 1945. There were two reasons for this. The first was that he felt the celebration of love had become formulaic and Breton's seductive lyricism rhetorical. The second was its limited recognition of human desire, the insistence in the book that every human being seeks the unique being of the opposite sex, the complementary. Fine, Moreau says, if this is meant allegorically, but it is not here. The affirmation that every human being seeks another of the opposite sex seems to us so gratuitous, so obscurantist, that it is as if the study of sexual psychology had not made the progress it has. Moreau sees this failure to recognize the diversity of human drives as a political as well as personal issue. As long as man does not have complete consciousness of his or her own intimate problems, of his or her sexuality, of good or bad orientation, he cannot pretend to lead nor to resolve collective conflicts. Moreau refers again to the Recherche sur la Sexualité, this time to regret that surrealism had not had the courage to continue and properly to investigate their simple line of questioning of human sexuality. There had been 12 sessions investigating sex, undertaken by the group between 1928 and 1932, and only the first two were published in La Révolution Surréaliste in 1928. And they are often cited for Breton's notorious refusal to tolerate the direction the conversation had taken towards a debate about same-sex desire. The conversations are, with this one exception, extraordinarily free, if at times rather burlesque. It is evident from Moreau's own work, as well as that of many of the surrealists, that a polymorphous sexuality is not just compatible with, but often at the core of its poetry and visual arts. And I just want to end with a little part of a poem from the collection called Lettres d'amour, or Love Letter, the cover of which you can see here with the inscriptions by a lot of his friends in many different languages, just saying Love Letter. And that in the centre, there, he said, was written by his own lover, although his own lover would never read the poems that were dedicated to him. And I quote, "I think of your body, which made our bed the sky and supreme mountains of the only reality, with its valleys and its shadows, with the moisture and the marble and black water reflecting all the stars in each eye." Thank you.